From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer and historian Melvin Bragg says the King James Bible has a fair claim as the most pivotal book ever written. It defined, he says, the English language as well as our approach towards science and education, even sex. It was the fuel of social movements, he says. It was used by enforcers of slavery and later by liberators. Bragg says the King James Bible gave the vocabulary and the model to the early development of democracy, and so it was crucial, he says, in shaping America. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Melvin Bragg about the best-selling book of all time, how it came about, and its influence on the way we worship and think and speak. The Book of Books, after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer and historian Melvin Bragg knows when you're talking about the influence of the King James Bible, there's a give and take. In his book about the impact of the Bible, he notes that while it may have fed some of the finest thinkers and artists of all time, it also persecuted some. It may have provided the energy that ended slavery, but its scriptures were also used by slave traders to justify the practice. Still, he says the impact on the world for good is unparalleled. Its influence on the English language and its literature on social movements and the creation of democracy, on the way it transformed the way we think about science and education and sex. Lord Bragg joined us to talk about his book. It's called The Book of Books. Lord Melvin Bragg is a novelist, an historian, a broadcaster. He was appointed to the British House of Lords in 1998. He's written many best-selling novels and nonfiction books, including The Adventure of English. He hosted the BBC arts program The South Bank Show for some 33 years. We should say that show is being revived by Sky Arts Network, and Lord Bragg is hosting some of those episodes. Again, his book is called The Book of Books, The Radical Impact of the King James Bible from 1611 to 2011. Lord Melvin Bragg, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for asking me. I'm delighted to be on the program with you.
I wanted to begin in the afterword to your book. You write about your first encounter with the King James Bible. You were six, and you joined, or anyway were conscripted, I guess, into the choir of St. Mary's Church in Wigton there. What was it that caught you up in the language of the Bible? Was it music, or was it the language at first?
Well, I joined the choir when I was six in 1945, just after the war ended. And a couple of my uncles were in the choir, and they frog marched me there.
Because the call went out for trebles, right. And I was put on a bench as a treble. And as I was the youngest choir boy, the service of the nine lessons and the nine carols meant that I had to read the first lesson. Traditionally, the youngest choir boy reads the lesson. And I read from Genesis, which included the sentence, "And the serpent beguiled her, and she did eat." And I piped this out, standing on a hassock, looking over the lectern. I didn't know anything about its meaning whatsoever, but I thought it was such a wonderful phrase. I kept going round the house saying, "And the serpent beguiled her, and she did eat." So maybe it started there, the lushness and the resonance of the language. And, of course, the singing. We had a good choir in that church, and you're singing great hymns and great psalms, immemorial in their age. And so it was the combination of the two, and that laid down a foundation which continued for many years.
Mm. You say that this book you've written grew out of that early experience. So when you were six, you say that the Bible for you was the truth about all of life, and now I guess it's more nuanced. You described it as a metaphor, as a poetic way of attempting to understand things. Is that sort of the trajectory that we take from the Bible, even the Bible itself, that it becomes about literal truth, and then it sort of transforms into something more fluid, maybe more... not quite as literal, I suppose.
Well, I think you have layers in your life, don't you? Yeah. I still have that layer that I had when I was a child and a young man of believing in the literalism of it. I absolutely believed that there was a resurrection and there was an ascension and there were miracles and the virgin birth and there was a Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I believed all of that. Mm. And it took me a long time to wean myself away from it. So that stays in an odd way. If you're foolish, you reject it. But it's a body of knowledge that you hold on to if you have any sensitivity. And you're quite right. It begins to transform. As in the New Testament, there's a transformation. The talk and the ideas move into a more spiritual, inspirational area, which you can take along with you, even if you begin to think, I don't know whether I completely believe in some of the fundamentals. This is when you're in middle age. In the older age, as I am now, you return to your tribe. One of my heroes, Lord Rees, Sir Martin Rees, who is head of the Royal Society, the longest living scientific society in the world, talks about the Church of England as his tribe. Mm. And he goes back to it, services are regularly, and I think it's my tribe. So it goes and it doesn't go. It's in and out of your life. I think only a few people take certain paths that they know for certain are the true paths. You hover around, and that's the position I'm in. There are certain intimations from my past and in the present. I mean, again, Rees and Hawking, the great scientist Hawking, said there are things that we shall never know. Mm. Well, what is outside there that we'll never know? We get intimations of it in sensations of passion and in dreaming and in certain despair that there's something else out there, some pulses. And that keeps the idea alive of another dimension to the daily lives that we go through. And so that is part of my religious experience still.
Mm. Part of what motivated you to write this book was your concern that the impact of the King James Bible was, I think you put it this way, being rubbed out of our history.
Yes, it is. It made me quite angry because I thought of writing something, just an essay or something like that. Then I read around it quite a lot and discovered that partly because of secularism in my country, I suspect more so in your country, and also a very militant atheism which rejects great bodies of knowledge, I think quite wrongly and mistakenly. Richard Dawkins is someone I would call a friend, but I dispute totally his views on God, religion, and the Bible. I think it's neither scholarly nor sensible and not true the way he attacks these great bodies of knowledge, but that's as may be. I think that, I don't know, it's very difficult to talk about directly, so could you rephrase the question in a slightly different way?
Well, I just wanted to know what motivated you to do this. It was, and you're talking about that kind of irritation, that concern, yeah, that the Bible, well, you talk about the Anglican Church, for example, that there is a correlation with the decline of the Anglican Church and the decline of the use of the King James Bible.
I slightly lost my way there then because I began to think about people who so frivolously reject the Bible. Yes, what made me angry was that in our history, and it's our joint history, your countries, perhaps even more than my country and other English-speaking countries, over the last 400 years, the Bible has had a central political effect. It in terms of one of the greatest things that happened in the history of humanity, so ever since civilization began, was the abolition of slavery. And it was triggered by and done by people who used the King James Bible in my country, in your country, and in the Afro-American community, that triple attack, which was a marvelous event in history. We haven't really settled down to its consequences yet. And secondly, another great event was the invention of modern democracy, which is, as Churchill said, maybe not a very good thing, but much better than anything else we've ever come up with. And again, the Bible was the seeding of that. It was there when that democracy was developed in the 1640s over here, and about the same time, then a few decades later, over there where you are, where you're speaking from at the moment. So these two things alone entitle it to a big place in our history, apart, of course, from its spectacular success as a book carrying the Protestant faith around the world, carrying a faith around the world. And the faith has been diminished in its importance in modern thought, sometimes I think quite unjustly. And at the same time, they've wiped out, those who diminish it have wiped out its effect on and its involvement with some of the greatest movements in our history. I've named two, slavery and democracy, but you could talk about the empowerment of women in the 19th century in your country, Jane Addams, and women who she wasn't a strict believer, she came from a Presbyterian family, as you know. She built up a community of people who believed and who served because of the Bible, philanthropists you had there, educationalists and so on. In many, many aspects of our life over the last 300 or 400 years, the Bible has been integral and extraordinarily important. And we seem to be content to rub it away and talk about economic movements, social movements, this and that. And yes, they played a part. But this book played a defining and crucial role. And it may be rather angry that it was being so easily wiped away. It's a great body of knowledge. We must respect great bodies of knowledge apart from anything else. And in this 400-year-old book, you have wisdom, knowledge, contradictions, complications, fine language, histories, mythologies, all there, beauty, poetry, all in that. To reject all that because you think you've moved on, I don't think you ever move on in knowledge. I think you have to take the past with you. And so that inspired me to sit down. I'm sorry to be so long-winded, but that inspired me to sit down and write this book.
No. This is perfect. I want to ask you, let's go back to the beginning. You get at where we how we came to a King James Version. At least that's how we describe it here. The writing of the King James Bible begins, you say, with blood and fear and the death of martyrs. And among them, of course, is William Tyndale. And I suppose if there is a hero in the story of the King James Bible, it's William Tyndale.
He's certainly my hero, I agree. The fight was to get the Bible into English. John Wycliffe tried in the 14th century and succeeded, and his young men from Oxford took the Bible around in manuscript around our country, and in one small period alone, 130 of them were caught, tortured, and burnt at the stake for trying to give the Bible in English to the English people. What was wrong? What was wrong that the church at that time had coloured Latin, that must be the only language of the Bible, and the state wanted to keep people out of great matters of state by not allowing them to join in the language they knew. That always happens. You keep people away from power by excluding them. They excluded people from the vote for hundreds of thousands of years. They excluded women from the vote for much longer, and they excluded people from the language. Wycliffe tried to get it through, and then came this man called Tyndale. And we're very fortunate in our language in many ways, but we have two great geniuses, Tyndale, the genius of translation, and Shakespeare, genius of imagination. Tyndale was a fantastic scholar, and he also had a sense of language and beat. You know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. Whether you're a Christian or not, it doesn't matter. The rhythm and pulse of that goes right through our language. And he brought more idioms into English than anybody before or since. Let there be light, fell flat on his face, let my people go, the apple of his eye, a man after his own heart, signs of the times, my brother's keeper, on and on they go. He profoundly enriched the language. And what did he get for his pains? He was tracked down by spies from Henry VIII's court and from the Pope's court, two lots of spies, in his mid-30s when he'd self-exiled himself to the Netherlands to find freedom, going from safe house to safe house. He was caught, this young man, put in a dungeon. He was taken to the scaffold. He was strangled. Just before he was strangled, he said, God, O Lord, open the eyes of the King of England. And then he was burnt on greenwood because it burnt more slowly, and he was burnt to death on that stake. But he'd left the New Testament, and he'd left the first five books of the Old and some of the other parts of the Old Testament. So he'd left the greatest legacy for many people in what we could easily say the greatest book written over the last 400 years.
You know, Tyndale's life is, which you spend a good amount of time just talking a bit about how he came to all of this. It was an obsession, you say, that he came to when he was very young, and he was brilliant at languages and at translation. And you say that you expect in some ways he may have been preparing himself for, as you put it, an unorthodox vocation.
Yes, he did. You're right. Curiously enough, he was influenced by King Alfred, the only king in English history who's been called the Great. King Alfred the Great, when he tried to bring England together, when the Vikings were knocking 10 bells out of us, he brought the English language into play in some of the commentaries on the Gospels. And Tyndale, as a boy of 9 or 10, was entranced by that. He went to Oxford University when he was about 14 or 15. He was just an unbelievably stunning scholar, supposed to be one of the first men in Europe who taught himself Hebrew, he knew Anglo-Saxon, Greek, Latin, French, Italian, German, and he could translate in and out of all those languages. But he had a genius for the fall of a line. And one thing that shows, I think, how he knew what was going to happen to him, he was being interviewed by a bishop for a post. He'd obviously been Startern at Oxford, and then he'd gone to Cambridge. And he was angry, and the bishop was so violent with him about his wanting to translate the Bible into English language. And Tyndale said, it's all recorded, there were people around, it was inquisitional times, I will teach a ploughboy to know the Bible as well as thee. Now that was brilliant, because the ploughboy in the High Middle Ages was the pure person. He nurtured the land. He reached right back to the apostles. And you must remember, this is a time when people absolutely believed that the Old Testament was the history of the world, right, and the apostles had been on it. And that was the first thing. But the second thing was that the ploughboy was illiterate. And he did his translation in as monosyllables, as simple as words as possible, so that it reached everyone, whether or not they could read. And that was to have a massive effect throughout the world.
It's so interesting. Also, you talk about how, and we'll come to this point when the King James version is translated, is created, but that it was intended to be read aloud. That was a crucial point, you say.
Absolutely. And it was enormously important, because when we say the King James version was put together, it was. There were these 47 or 52 scholars, it doesn't really matter which, when King James decided in 1603-4 that there would be a new version of the Bible, and it's by 1611 they had it. And they say in the introduction they borrowed from other versions, but what they didn't say was that in the New Testament they took 85% from William Tyndale. Yeah. And in the first five books of the Old Testament, they took nearly 90% directly from Tyndale. And it was Tyndale's words that Shakespeare had heard in his church. And again, Shakespeare's quoting from Tyndale. Shakespeare quotes from the Bible over 1,350 times. He refers to 42 different books in the Bible. Cain he refers to 25 times, Job 25 times, and so on. He was saturated in it. And it was Tyndale who set that rolling.
I want to ask about when we get to the part of the story where the King James Version is first commissioned. You of course, get to King James, and you write that the Puritans had high hopes for King James, but he disappointed them. He turned on them, as you say. But he did take the one idea, at least one anyway, to consider a new translation of the Bible. What is it that King James wanted from this? I guess he was looking for glory and extravagance.
Well, partly, but you're right, he turned on them. He was brought up a strict Presbyterian. We're talking about a man who was a king when he was 1 year old. Right. He was King James VI of Scotland. We're also talking about a boy at the age of eight who could translate any passage blind from the Bible into English and French and Latin and back again. He was a serious biblical scholar, and he prided himself on it. And it was biblical scholarship among that Presbyterian communities up in Scotland at the time was fierce. And it was a fierce, severe, austere religion. He came down south to be king into this lush pastures and lands of rich England with its pageants and courts and masks. And I think he was seduced by it. He thought, this is wonderful. He said to his fellow Scotsman, I will return every... He only went back once in 20-odd years. and he had Hampton Court. I mean, this is the castle of 1,000 rooms built by Cardinal Wolsey. He was there. So he loved it. But he stuck to the Bible, and you're right, Reynolds, a Presbyterian scholar, because James had argued against them at the Hampton Court Conference, against the Presbyterians. He spoke at one time for 9 hours. Wow. And Reynolds said, well, at least let us have a new Bible. And James said yes. Now, there's visionary interpretations. A, it flattered him that it should be his Bible.
Yeah.
He would take an interest, which he did. And also, he wanted a Bible that reflected his view of Protestantism. Mm. And he thought that the other Bibles going around at the time were too disputatious and argumentative and were taken away from the Word of God. He was a very sincere Christian. And the Bibles that were being printed in the English language on the continent were full of commentaries saying a king was really a tyrant and all that sort of thing. He didn't want any of that, not being a king. And himself. So
right.
So he got on with it. And some people say it was a political move to bring the kingdom together. And perhaps it was. It certainly did. It became our national book, just as in many ways. The people who left England, even before James came to the throne after it, they were people of the book. They took the book with them. They went to found a new England. They went to found a better place because they thought God was leaving England, that is, the old England. And they went bravely, with incredible sort of courage, to the East Coast to found a new place to live proper lives, according to this book.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too, that James, as you say, a firm believer in the divine right of a king, that only really a king could directly speak with God. And as you say, he stripped out we don't find the word tyrant in this in the King James Version. But what's also extraordinary was the fact that, as you say, he left room for people to maneuver. I mean, the language of the Bible they created, you say, had these ambiguities that left it open for, of course, for the establishment. That's what James had in mind. But also for the counterculture. That, I guess that's what's so brilliant about the Bible.
It's most extraordinary. You could prove arguments with the Bible, and you can prove with other parts of the Bible arguments against your own argument. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons why it's so long-lasting. It's so full of contradictions, and yet great scholars can make it one sacred book and say it serves one purpose. Yes, it does serve counter-arguments. As you know, the books of the Bible, 66 of them we have now, written at different times by different hands, although, of course, at that time, the time of James, it was thought to be dictated to Moses by God. Or it came down through the apostles directly from Christ. That was what people of the highest intelligence, like Shakespeare and Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton, they believed that totally. But it is full of contradictions, which is marvellous in a way. It couldn't have been better planned, because people could always say, but this happens there. I mean, slavery is a wonderful example. Mm-hmm. I do think, that was the biggest surprise for me, Doug. It was almost, I always felt tears when I read all about that, because the slavery, the idea of people being enslaved, every civilization you look at, from the Babylonian, the Assyrian, the Egyptian, the Greek, the Roman, even up to Tudor England and beyond, was full of slavery. Africa was full of slavery, India, China. And this Bible, through Wilberforce in this country, through men and women in your country, and through a great number of people in the Black American community in the southern parts of the state, through this Bible, through quotations they got from this Bible, they drove it away. It was an extraordinary example of an act of great morality transcending politics. There's been very few things like it in all history. Mm. And that was driven by the Bible.
You also write about how slaves themselves in America were educated through the King James Bible, and how they built this common language from it. And you see it in music, in gospel music, in blues, and jazz, and eventually even rock. All sort of bound up in the King James Version of the Bible in many ways.
Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, what the Bible gave... When the English Methodists, the Wesley brothers, with their 8,000 hymns, and John Whitefield went to the United States, they were the first people, as far as we know, to go into the black areas in the southern states and preach to people. They wanted to capture souls. They weren't doing social work. They wanted to capture souls. That was their purpose. They were evangelical. And, of course, Tyndale's Bible was wonderful because they spoke, and a lot of these people who were illiterate but extremely intelligent had wonderful memories, because that's the way they transferred knowledge from one generation to another. And they remembered this. And they built their own churches in the swamps. I've been there. I've seen them. And they preached the word back. And then what these Methodists did, they ordained Black Baptists, Black Methodists into the church. And away it started. And a language swept across the slave holdings, instead of different tribal languages and different dialects, there was also this one language which they used. And then they brilliantly, the Methodists had started singing, they turned it into their own songs, and they used just chunks of the Bible, from Let My People Go, or Swing Low, whatever it is. All these great spirituals and gospel songs started, and then, as you rightly say, it goes through to rock and roll, even as far as that, and it really does. And it's America's unique contribution to world culture. It's extraordinary. And it starts there, again, through the Bible. And again, that takes a lot of arguing for people to understand that. Well, Lord not Melvin. To understand it, to accept it. Not to understand it, to accept it,
Lord Melvin Bragg, he's the author of The Book of Books, The Radical Impact of the King James Bible from 1611 to 2011. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The King James Version of the Bible is one of the world's best-selling books, and the writer and historian Melvin Bragg says it's also one of the fundamental makers of the world. Lord Bragg has written about its history and its influence. His book is called The Book of Books, The Radical Impact of the King James Bible from 1611 to 2011. Here's an email from Susie, who writes from Salt Lake City. When I was in school at the University of Utah to become a teacher of students with visual impairments, I learned that the first book produced in Braille was the Bible. Because of this, the 189 contractions used in Braille have been greatly affected by the language and the words used in the Bible. Interesting. How did it work, Lord Bragg, the way it was translated? You explained the process, and how long did it take to create this Bible?
Well, the final Bible put together, King James Version, took about 7 years. They drew on other versions, particularly Tyndale's version. There were four groups of about 12 scholars, one in Oxford, one in Cambridge, two groups in London, and they just divided it up and took bits between them. We were very rich in scholars at that time, as it happened, a great number of people who knew Hebrew and Greek and Latin and so on very well indeed. And they translated or retranslated or just took from other books. They particularly took from Tyndale. And then they brought them all together and it was finalized in a place called the Jerusalem Chamber in Westminster Abbey. And they sat round in a circle. But the interesting thing is, to me anyway, given what Tyndale did, is that they didn't pass notes to each other and say, do you think this works or that works? They read it aloud.
Right.
They read it aloud to each other before they put down the final transcription. And they got it done in quite good time. And a private printer printed it. He had a monopoly. He went broke and ended up in jail, as it happened. But still, he printed this.
Cost 12 shillings, you say?
Yes, he printed. Yeah, it was a fortune.
Was
he
it?
He printed this great tome, and it began to push its way into the churches. Mm. People had a little Bible called the Geneva Bible. That was because it was translated in Geneva. It was in English, and they took the first Bibles they took to the United States. What became the United States was the Geneva Bible, and it was. But then it was over two or three decades. It was supplanted by the King James Version, or the King James Version worked alongside it. Mm. Partly because of, again, the language, and partly because James and the subsequent king enforced censorship, so people producing the Geneva Bible in Geneva didn't get their Bibles into the country.
Hmm. You write about, I love this part, where you talk about how there were mistakes made and misprints. They left out "not" from the commandment, "thou shalt not commit adultery," for example.
Yeah, that was called the Wicked Bible, wasn't it? So "thou shalt commit adultery," yes.
Right. And it didn't take at first, you say. It took a while for it to come to be what we've come to know it as, I suppose.
Yes, it did. It took about two, three decades, 1611, 20. It took until about 1630s, 1640s. That's partly because this book was so important to people that they'd got used to the versions they had, whatever the versions were. This was a massive entrance into the world of thought. At last, ordinary people could read or learn about all these stories, all these psalms, all these notions, all these events at first hand. They didn't have little bits from Latin as it was translated or mistranslated from them. It was their book, and it was a sensation for them. It was liberated them into thought. The previous version of the Bible enforced them to duty in Latin, but this, because it was in English, liberated them into thought. They could think, they could interpret, they could argue. They could say, well, when Jesus said that, did he mean that? When Solomon did that, was he right to do that? It must have been extraordinary the way the parts of our brain that produce language are sort of fired right across the land. And that in itself was a radical difference that it made. But it did. It took a bit of time, but people got used to what they did, and then they got used to this Bible, and it became in your country the King James Version, and then it began to gradually take over, and it got its grip, and for many people, it's never lost it.
Mm. Well into the 20th century, it was sort of the standard English Bible, and
yes.
I wondered what it is that you make of these new versions. I mean, there seems to be an attempt at making the language, which seems in some ways to be what Tyndale was about, of course, in some way, but making the language more simple or maybe less florid, maybe, or, you know, out of date. I mean, what do you make of the comparisons that you're seeing between the language of the King James Version and, for example, here's one. I was just taking note of this morning. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And the Good News translation, the Lord is my shepherd, I have everything I need.
Well, there's no comparison, is there?
Right.
I shall not want is perfect monosyllables. I have everything I need. Well, what's everything you need? It's I shall not want covers the whole waterfront. that's what Tyndale meant. He thinks that that's what the original people who wrote the Bible meant. I think my view is that they should be run in parallel. I completely understand that people want modernized versions, and some of them are good modernized versions. They're a different thing from the King James Bible. And they should, I think, keep the King James Version going, keep it in, certainly it is in print, but keep it in schools, in assemblies, in churches, so we don't lose it, because by losing it, we lose our connections with the past. This isn't just a book. This is a book of our history. This is an extraordinary, precious document. Very few civilizations have had what your country and mine and Australia and New Zealand have had for the last 400 years, which is a national book, which is also a sacred book, which is also a book of learning, all those things at once. So I think it ought to run in parallel. I'd just like to say two more things. First of all, people who say it's difficult, well, it isn't all that difficult. I mean, it's very simple language. And if there are difficulties, I mean, that's what teachers and preachers are for, to explain them, isn't it? And secondly, if you're just going to say we must modernize everything about our past, well, why don't we look around Europe at some of the greatest buildings ever built, the cathedrals of Europe, and say, oh, goodness me, these are too tall and too drafty and we can't keep them heated and warm. Let's knock them down and build a modern building with full of modern communications and such. Now, that would seem to be silly, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. But we're doing exactly the same as that with the Bible.
I read where you said Shakespeare is difficult, but we don't find someone to rewrite it.
No, we don't. We do different versions of it, but nobody says, let's rewrite it and let's get rid of it. People go to Shakespeare and they make the effort and take the trouble. And once you get the hang of it, it's fine. And that's happening still now. And that's been because people have been resolute in the area of poetry and art, but not as resolute in the area of religion, which is a pity. Well, it's the same with the great paintings. I mean, a lot of people say, well, we can't understand these paintings of saints and people on the cross and a virgin suckling a child, and we don't really understand that. Well, it doesn't take too much explanation to understand. And secondly, they're wonderful paintings. And thirdly, what's the solution? Do we just clean the canvases and do other paintings above it? No, we don't have to, I suppose. We're a free society. But history is to be absorbed. We're quite right to reject some of the bad parts of it. But the great history, great part of our past has to be absorbed. Otherwise, we're rootless. Otherwise, we're embalmed in the superficialities of the present.
I want to ask about the influence of the King James Bible on the movement of democracy, which you write about, which kind of takes us back to the fact that the King James Version was instrumental in the execution of a divine monarch, in fact, King James' son.
Yes, I think if there is one key moment where democracy, modern democracy, as it were, kick-started, and people, historians, don't like one key moment, but there was the shot at Sarajevo, there was the shot that rang around the world on the bridge in Concord. There are key moments, a little bit that starts an avalanche. There are things that trigger things. And the idea of there being a rule which was not ordained by a king, but opposed by other people who said, we the people, was around very much in the 17th century. It came together to cut to the chase in the British Parliament, in the Civil War, in the 1640s, when in that war more British men were killed per capita than were killed in the First World War, where we lost hundreds and hundreds of thousands. It was a bloody, bloody war. Mm. And they wanted, the opposition to Charles, wanted to get rid of the king. Now, the traditional way of getting rid of an unpopular king in our country was to assassinate them. But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to do it through the Bible. And they argued about how to do this. They looked in the Bible for examples where God had cast down a king, a tyrant, Nebuchadnezzar. They looked through that. We're told that on the nights before the battles, the great battles, exactly as in your civil wars, precisely the same things happened. Before they're going into battle, they're talking about the Bible. They're talking about the text. In that case, in your case, in slavery. In this case, what do we do with the divinely appointed king? As you correctly say, Charles I absolutely, truly believed, and so did those opposing him, that he alone could talk to God, and God talked only to kings. And what did you do about that? It was repeated in civilization. The pharaohs thought the same. The emperors of Rome thought the same. The Aztec kings thought the same. It's always been that position. They alone, they have the exclusive right. And these men, because it was all men at that time, tried him, which was an extraordinary thing to do, in the Great Hall, in the Great Hammer-Beamed Hall in London, opposite Westminster Abbey. And they tried King Charles I with a proper jury and common law. It had never been done before, anyway. And he was found guilty under law, and 3 days later he was executed. And that sent a ripple across Europe and America. The discussions began on the river, upriver from the Westminster, the Putney debates, where the idea of democracy came in. It accelerated the ideas of democracy, which were so very well developed in the eastern coastal settlements that the new Americans had made over there. That, I think, was the beginning, and it was through the Bible that it was argued. And without the Bible, they would not have thought they had the authority to do it. And the cautious, stumbling, slow, but eventually successful transference of a whole state of humankind to democracy began by the agency of the Bible. And it's a remarkable thing. And you find that very rarely alluded to in any sonorous or severe sense in the history books, which is a shame. And it's a bit of a disgrace, really.
Let's go to the phones. Paul is with us in Lehi, Utah. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning. I read the book God's Secretaries and found the history just fascinating, and I'm glad for the chance to ask a question as to why the King James writers often used prose form, such as in Job or the Psalms or Isaiah, rather than the poetic Hebrew, which personally I'm not familiar with and couldn't translate. And I'm wondering if, for instance, the book of Isaiah might have been easier for modern readers to comprehend if it had been broken up in poetic lines. Thank you.
Well, I think that's a very good suggestion. You may well be right. Tyndale wasn't alive long enough to work on the book of Isaiah because he, as you know, with the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, he moved easily into poetry. But you could well be right there. I think they did the best they could to get, in their terms, an accurate translation which would leap from the page to a people who'd been starved of any intellectual language their entire lives. But you've made a very good point.
Glad you called.
It's interesting you talk about Isaiah because the morning before he was shot, Martin Luther King Jr., as you know, was preaching on a text from Isaiah.
Mm. Well, Martin Luther King, another influence you mentioned. His I Have a Dream speech came, of course, from the King James Version of the Bible, of Isaiah.
Yes.
Lord Melvin Bragg, he's the author of The Book of Books, The Radical Impact of the King James Bible from 1611 to 2011. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer and historian Melvin Bragg. Lord Bragg calls the King James Version of the Bible one of the fundamental makers of the modern world. His book is called The Book of Books, The Radical Impact of the King James Bible from 1611 to 2011. Let's go back to the phones. Dennis is with us in Farmington, Utah. Dennis, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I've been an atheist for 10 years, primarily thanks to actually picking up the Bible and reading it. But one argument I hear among atheists and Christians is Christians, they point out all these things where the Bible was a force for good, like getting rid of slavery, but it was also the source, one of the excuses to bring back slavery. And my position has always been that the Bible is a convenient vehicle or excuse to push your agenda. And I kind of wonder if these things like the end of slavery wouldn't have happened anyway without the Bible. They would have just found another moral argument for that.
Lord Bragg, you were making that point earlier, I suppose, that it's kind of elastic sometimes, the Bible.
Yes. I mean, I made a lot of very good points there. I think that I agree with you, basically, in the sense that the Bible can be used for your own agenda, whatever it is. The Bible in the Old Testament is full of examples of people being in slavery and implicitly God condoning it. So people who held on to slavery said, look, there's slavery in the Old Testament, so that's okay. Just like there's slavery in Greece, that's okay. So it can prove different things. And Galatians and Ephesians in the New Testament says something else. So it can prove different things. So that's true. But I want to say one thing here before all others, is that the Bible is massively criticized, particularly by atheists, as being almost uniquely wicked. Because of the Inquisition, and because of it has been used by people in the promulgation of wicked acts. I think that completely maintains your point. It's power that's wicked, and powerful men, it's usually been men, have always used any ideology or any religion or any excuse to get more power. The biggest massacre that this planet has ever seen on a human scale was in the 8th century China, when somewhere between a sixth and a quarter of the world population was killed in a battle. Not a single person there was a Christian. When the Mongols came over in the High Middle Ages to this part of Europe, 40 million people were killed. The Mongols had never heard of Christianity. In the last century, when we look at the people who perpetrated the most tremendous crimes against humanity, whether it was in Russia or in Germany or Pol Pot or Mao in China, no Christianity there. So Christianity is far from being uniquely wicked. What is wicked again and again are men who want to have more and more power over the rest of humankind. And for them, a religion is often a wonderful convenience because it gives them an aura, it gives them a sense of destiny, and that sort of thing. So you can use it for that end, I agree. But you can't deny, in my view, that on the whole, the Bible has been a massive force for good. Now, your argument that slavery would have been abolished anyway, I would dispute that very, very strongly. It's a sort of, with the greatest respect, it's an argument that nobody can win, so where do you go? What we do know is that the Bible was the trigger. The Bible was integral to the abolition of slavery. The Bible was liberation theology for the black Africans in your country for two or three centuries and drove it through. The Bible was something which organized the forces against slavery. Would it have happened without the Bible? Well, it's one of those impossible questions. And I think it's the sort of trap that certain atheists said, look, it would have happened anyway. Oh, this would have happened. I'm not so sure. History takes the course it takes because certain things do happen. And what did happen was that the force in people's lives of that sacred book, as people thought it, and that book full of great ideas, as it certainly was, and positive and humane ideas, caught the imagination and inspired the morality of people who went out to change things. And that's my view of that.
Dennis, glad you called. Back to the phones. And Tim, with us in Cedar City. Tim, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. This is certainly interesting. I am wanting to address the question. I'm trying to be concise with this. Is the what I'm calling a political contradiction or a mechanism where the empiricism of science is found versus the imposed mythology of the Bible, of the Quran, and in our present, we live in Utah here amongst the Mormons who have their own inspirational scripture, and how we're going to, as a society, as a culture, evolve out of what is a contradiction between the empiricism of science, the power of science, versus imposed mythology of the Bible.
Lord Bragg, you write, there is, of course, this division between science and religion, and you say it takes some imagination to go back to a time when religion and science were mutually affirming. It's a point you make in the book. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes. I mean, ages of thought move on and they change. And the Greeks believed that there were multiple gods and goddesses, and we don't believe that now, and different things in different civilizations. So things do change and move. I don't think they move on. They move. Mm. And the idea of trying to explain how a Bunsen burner affects a piece of litmus paper through the book of Genesis isn't going to get you very far. They're different sorts of knowledge. They're different bodies of knowledge. But I don't think the one cancels out the other. I really don't. And let me just give you a little example. Now, I'll be as concise as you so brilliantly have been. Where in the 1650s in this country, after the execution of King Charles I, the Royal Society started, and very soon it was joined by Newton and some of the greatest scientists, according to Einstein, who'd ever lived. Boyle, who invented chemistry, Hooker, so each one of those men was profoundly religious. And they didn't just read the Bible a bit in the evening. They believed it. And they believed what Francis Bacon, the great courtier and Chancellor of England at the time, James I, thought. There are two books in the world. The one is the book of nature. The other is the book of scriptures. Interrogate both and bring them together. So they thought that when they were looking into experimental science, looking through microscopes and telescopes and looking through the mathematics of the universe, which Newton was doing, they were discovering what God had put there. Now, the interesting question, which Martin Rees, again, Lord Rees, president of the Royal Society, said, and so do others, they were finding orders in the universe and a way of looking at it, which was entirely biblical. They were looking for a first cause. Why were they looking for a first cause? Because according to Newton and people like that, there was a first cause in their view, and that was God. So there had to be a first cause in the physics of the universe. So religion, even in that area, carried into science. Now, I'm not saying for a moment that you, as I said at the beginning, that a mythology can help an experiment in science. But there are different bodies of knowledge. And it's, I think it is, it's unwise, and I also think it's rather rude to just push aside, as Richard Dawkins, as bodies of knowledge, previous bodies of knowledge, as if they had no use anymore because we'd gone further. I'm of the opinion we often don't go further. I'm of the opinion we go around in infinitely enriching circles if we're lucky, and we go down in infinitely impoverishing spirals if we're not.
What do you figure, Lord Bragg, happened to that balance as you describe it? If many of the pioneering scientists saw it as a balance that between religion and science. What do you figure happened? Was it inevitable, you figure?
Well, there are quite a, it rusted into the 20th century in this country. I mean, the man who, as it were, scientifically proved Einstein's views, that is, went and made the observation, who proved it, was a Quaker called Eddington, a very religious man. I mean, bodies of knowledge move on. Yeah. There are still many religious people who are scientists, but I think very few of them bring their science to religion. They don't let the religion, as it were, dictate what they do in their laboratories or in the Hadron Collider. But I think it's part of their view of what the world, what the shape and sense of the world is really like. I don't think it's entirely gone away. I think there are people who believe that there are things that we don't know and that we'll never know. And I think that people who believe that the idea that reason has explained everything, which is one of the I respect Richard Dawkins' view of he reasons away God, which is not very difficult to do. But the point is, do you think that reason is all that triumphant? I mean, do you think that reason is the most important faculty? Hume, David Hume, a philosopher with the greatest respect, far greater than Richard Dawkins, thought that reason came as a result of passions and sensations, and it came after feeling, after those sort of spiritual thoughts almost. So I don't think it's as cut and dried as that.
You've written, Lord Bragg, that about how when you went to university, you lost the faith of your youth, and many do, but you've written that this book has helped you come to kind of respect the best of that faith again.
Oh, yes. I mean, I went to university like I'm sure a lot of your listeners. There's that glorious period that we all have in our lives where we know everything. It's wonderful. It lasts about 6 months, and then you realize that you know very little, and you spend the rest of your life discovering how little you do know. It's a sort of liberation from everything when you get away from home, including. But I don't think that the idea of there being things that are not known, things that, and also bodies of knowledge that are worth respecting, I don't think that ever went away. And I'm in a position of, in terms of religion, I suppose, sort of, how can I describe it? Not passivity, but receptive and interested and wondering what's going to turn up.
Mm. I mentioned the church you attended as a young man, St. Mary's in Wigton. The north side of this church, you write that there were some empty windows, and you decided to fill them with stained glass as a tribute to your parents and your family.
Yes, I did. I was always sorry for those windows because it's a little 18th century church, and those three windows didn't have any stained glass in them, and the rest did. So I decided to commission and get them, they're quite big windows, get some lovely stained glass in and designed. What I wanted was windows which showed the congregation. And you had to fight with the authorities in England. They're quite stern about that in the Anglican Church. But I wanted the town to be in these windows. I wanted there to be the factory and the farmers and the auction and cows and pigs and the shops and the cross in the middle of the town. It was a memorial cross, not and so on, and the streets. And these to be on the windows, so that the town came into the church, and a little rim of light around the windows so you could look out of those windows even so and see the town itself. And we did that eventually, got it through the various committees, including committees at St. Andrew's in the wardrobe, and there they are.
You say you wanted to bring the town back into the church, I guess, just like your family.
I just thought the church, and I always thought that the church really is the congregation. Buildings are fine, and some are stunning and beautiful, and some are humble and just as good, really. But it's a congregation. The Celtic monks believed that you could stop in a field and be as near to God as you could in any great church and so on. And I always like Celtic monks. I come from that part of the world, the north of England, where the Celtic monks roamed around in the 6th and 7th centuries. And that's always appealed to me. So I wanted to talk about the people who'd made the church. It isn't the church who makes the people. It's the other way around.
Melvin Bragg, he is the author of the book, The Book of Books, The Radical Impact of the King James Bible, 1611 to 2011, joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Lord Bragg, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you to you and your guests.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tim Slover. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.